From Elmhurst Public Library, this is Storytime for Grown-Ups. I am Margie Kohlbacher. Welcome to episode 11. Stories have the power to inspire and change us. Being read to stimulates our brains, expands our imaginations, and is just plain fun. We welcome back our guest reader, Cheryl Rice. Cheryl will read two essays by Nora Ephron. You might know Nora best through her screenplay writing for movies such as When Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle. Our selections come from her book entitled I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections. Also presented today is a personal story written by our reader-in-residence, Duard Mosley. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
I Remember Nothing by Nora Ephron. I have been forgetting things for years, at least since I was in my 30s. I know this because I wrote something about it at the time. I have proof. Of course, I can't remember exactly where I wrote about it or when, but I could probably hunt it up if I had to. In my early days of forgetting things, words would slip away and names. I did what you normally do when that happens. I scrolled through a mental dictionary, trying to figure out what letter the word began with and how many syllables were involved. Eventually, the lost thing would float back into my head, recaptured. I never took such lapses as harbingers of doom or old age or actual senescence. I always knew that whatever I'd forgotten was going to come back to me sooner or later. Once I went to a store to buy a book about Alzheimer's disease and forgot the name of it. I thought it was funny. And it was, at the time. Here's a thing I've never been able to remember. The title of that movie with Jeremy Irons. The one about Klaus von Bülow, you know the one. All I ever succeeded in remembering was that it was three words long, and the middle word was of. For many years, this did not bother me at all, because no one I knew could ever think of the title either. One night, eight of us were at the theater together, and not one of us could retrieve it. Finally, at intermission, someone went out to the street and Googled it. We were all informed of the title, and we all vowed to remember it forever. For all I know, the other seven did. I, on the other hand, am back to remembering that it's three words long with an of in the middle. By the way, when we finally learned the title that night, we all agreed it was a bad title. No wonder we didn't remember it. I'm going to Google for the name of that movie. I'll be right back. It's Reversal of Fortune. How is one to remember that title? It has nothing to do with anything. But here's the point. I have been forgetting things for years, but now I forget in a new way. I used to believe I could eventually retrieve whatever was lost and then commit it to memory. Now I know I can't possibly. Whatever's gone is hopelessly gone. And what's new doesn't stick. The other night, I met a man who informed me that he had a neurological disorder and he couldn't remember the faces of people he'd met. He said that sometimes he looked at himself in a mirror and he had no idea whom he was looking at. I don't mean to minimize this man's ailment, which I'm sure is a bona fide syndrome with a long name that's capitalized, but all I could think was, welcome to my world. A couple of years ago, the actor Ryan O'Neill confessed that he'd recently failed to recognize his own daughter, Tatum, at a funeral, and had accidentally made a pass at her. Everyone was judgmental about this, but not me. A month earlier, I'd found myself in a mall in Las Vegas when I saw a very pleasant-looking woman coming toward me, smiling, her arms outstretched, and I thought, who is this woman? Where do I know her from? Then she spoke, and I realized it was my sister, Amy. You might think, well, how was she to know her sister would be in Las Vegas? I'm sorry to report that not only did I know, but she was the person I was meeting at the mall. All of this makes me feel sad and wistful, but mostly it makes me feel old. I have many symptoms of old age, aside from the physical. I occasionally repeat myself. I use the expression, when I was young. Often I don't get the joke, although I pretend that I do. If I go see a movie or a play for the second time, it's as if I didn't see it at all the first time, even if the first time was just recently. And I have no idea who anyone in People magazine is. I used to think that my problem was that my disc was full. Now I am forced to conclude that the opposite's true. It's becoming empty. I have not yet reached the nadir of old age, the land of anecdote, but I'm approaching it. I know. I should have kept a journal. I should have saved the love letters. I should have taken a storage room somewhere in Long Island City for all the papers I thought I'd never need to look at again. But I didn't. And sometimes I'm forced to conclude that I remember nothing. For example, I met Eleanor Roosevelt. It was June 1961, and I was on my way to a political internship at the Kennedy White House. All the Wellesley Vassar interns drove to Hyde Park to meet the former First Lady. Oh, I was dying to meet her. I'd grown up with a photograph in our den of her standing with my parents backstage at a play that they had written. My mother was wearing a corsage, and Eleanor wore pearls. It was a photograph I'd always thought of as iconic, if I'm using that word correctly, which if I am, it will be for the first time. We were among the thousands of Americans, mostly Jews, who had dens, and in their dens, photos of Eleanor Roosevelt. I idolized that woman. I couldn't believe I was going to be in the same room with her. So, what was she like that day in Hyde Park, you may wonder? I have no idea. I can't remember what she said or what she wore. I can barely summon up a mental picture of the room where we met her, although I do have a very vague memory of drapes. But here's what I do remember. I got lost on the way. And ever since, every time I've been on the Taconic State Parkway, I'm reminded that I got lost there on the way to meet Eleanor Roosevelt. But I don't remember a single thing about Eleanor Roosevelt herself. In 1964, the Beatles came to New York for the first time. I was a newspaper reporter, and I was sent to the airport to cover their arrival. It was a Friday. I spent the weekend following them around. Sunday night, they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. You could make an argument that the 60s began that night on the Ed Sullivan Show. It was a historic night, and I was there. I stood in the back of the Ed Sullivan Theater and watched. I remember how amazingly obnoxious the fans were, the teenage girls who screamed and yelled and behaved like idiots. But how were the Beatles, you may ask? Well, you're asking the wrong person. I could barely hear them. I marched on Washington to protest the war in Vietnam. This was in 1967, and it was the most significant event of the anti-war movement. Thousands and thousands of people were there. I went with a lawyer I was dating. We spent most of the day in a hotel room having sex. I'm not proud of this, but I mention it because it explains why I honestly cannot remember anything about the protest, including whether I ever even got to the Pentagon. I don't think I did. I don't think I've ever been to the Pentagon, but I wouldn't bet a nickel on it one way or the other. Norman Mailer wrote an entire book about this march called The Armies of the Night. It was 288 pages long. It won the Pulitzer Prize. And I can barely write two paragraphs about it. If you knew Norman Mailer and me and were asked to guess which of us cared more about sex, you would, of course, pick Norman Mailer. How wrong you would be. Here are some people I met that I remember nothing about. Justice Hugo Black, Ethel Merman, Jimmy Stewart, Alger Hiss, Senator Hubert Humphrey, Cary Grant, Benny Goodman, Peter Ustinov, Harry Kernitz, George Abbott, Dorothy Parker. I went to the Bobby Riggs Billie Jean King tennis match and couldn't really see anything from where I was sitting. I went to stand in front of the White House the night Nixon resigned, and here's what I have to tell you about that. my wallet was stolen. I went to many legendary rock concerts and spent them wondering when they would end and where we would eat afterward and whether the restaurant would still be open and what I would order. I went to at least 100 Knicks games, and I remember only the night that Reggie Miller scored 8 points in the last 9 seconds. I went to cover the war in Israel in 1973, but my therapist absolutely forbid me to go to the front. I was not at Woodstock, but I might as well have been because I wouldn't remember it anyway. On some level, my life has been wasted on me. After all, if I can't remember it, who can? The past is slipping away, and the present is a constant affront. I can't possibly keep up. When I was younger, I managed to overcome my resistance to new things. After a short period of negativity, I flung myself at the Cuisinart food processor. I was curious about technology. I became a champion of email and blogs. I found them romantic. I even made a movie about them. But now I believe that almost anything new has been put on the earth in order to make me feel bad about my dwindling memory. And I've erected a wall to protect myself from most of it. On the other side of that wall are many things pinging. For the most part, I pay no attention. For a long time, I didn't know the difference between the Sunnis and the Shias, but there were so many pings that I was finally forced to learn. But I can't help wondering, why did I bother? Wasn't it enough to know that they didn't like each other? And in any case, I have now forgotten. At this moment, some of the things I am refusing to know anything about include the former Soviet republics, the Kardashians, Twitter, all housewives, survivors, American idols, and bachelors, Karzai's brother, soccer, monkfish, Jay-Z, and every drink invented since the Cosmopolitan, especially that drink made with crushed mint leaves. You know the one. I'm going to Google the name of that drink. Be right back. The mojito. I am living in the Google years, no question of that. And there are advantages to it. When you forget something, you can whip out your iPhone and go to Google. The senior moment has become the Google moment. And it has a much nicer, hipper, younger, more contemporary sound, doesn't it? By handling the obligations of the search mechanism, you can almost prove that you can keep up. You can delude yourself that no one at the table thinks of you as a geezer. And finding that missing bit is so quick now. There's none of the nightmare of the true senior moment, that long search for the answer, the guessing, the self-recrimination, the head-slapping mystification, the frustrated finger-snapping. You just go to Google and retrieve it. You can't retrieve your life. Oh, unless you're on Wikipedia, in which case you can retrieve an inaccurate version of it. But you can retrieve the name of that actor who was in that movie, the one about World War II, and the name of that writer who wrote that book, the one about her affair with that painter. Or the name of that song that was sung by that singer, the one about love. You know the one. Who Are You? By Nora Ephron. I know you. I know you. I know you well. It's true that I always have a little trouble with your name, but I do know your name. I just don't know it at this moment. We're at a big party. We've kissed hello. We've had a delightful conversation about how we are the last two people on the face of the earth who don't kiss on both cheeks. Now we're having a conversation about how phony all the people are who do kiss on both cheeks. Oh, you're so charming. If only I could remember your name. It's inexcusable that I can't. You've been to my house for dinner. I tried to read your last book. I know your girlfriend's name, or I almost know it. It's something like Chanel, only it's not. Chantel? That's not it either. Well, fortunately, she isn't here, so I haven't forgotten both of your names. I'm becoming desperate. It's something like Larry. Is it Larry? No, it's not. Jerry? No, it's not. but it ends in a Y. Your last name, three syllables, starts with a C. Starts with a G? I'm losing my mind. But a miracle occurs. The host is about to toast the guest of honor. Thank God I can escape to the bar. Have we met? I think we've met. But I can't be sure. We were introduced, but I didn't catch your name because it's so noisy at this party. I'm going to assume we know each other, and I'm not going to say, nice to meet you. If I say, nice to meet you, I know what will happen. You'll say, we've met. You'll say, we've met in a sort of aggressive, irritable tone. And you won't even tell me your name so I can recover in some way. So I'm not going to say, nice to meet you. I'm going to say, nice to see you. I'll have a big smile on my face. I won't look desperate. But what I'll be thinking is, please throw me your name. Please, please, please give me a hint. My husband is likely to walk up and I'll have to introduce you and I won't be able to. And you'll know that I have no idea who you are, even though we probably spent an entire weekend together on a boat in 1984. I have a secret signal with my husband that involves my pinching him very hard on the upper arm. The signal means, throw your name at this person because I have no idea whom I'm talking to. But my husband always forgets the secret signal and can't be counted on to respond to my pinching, even when it produces a bruise. I would like to chew my husband out about his forgetfulness on this point, but I'm not exactly in a position to do so since I myself have forgotten, if I ever knew it, the name of the person I'm talking to. Old friends. Old friends, we must be. You're delighted to see me, and I'm delighted to see you. But who are you? Oh my God, you're Ellen. I can't believe it. Ellen. Ellen, how are you? How long has it been? I'd like to suggest that the reason I didn't recognize you right off the bat is that you've done something to your hair. But you've done nothing to your hair, nothing that would excuse my not recognizing you. What you've actually done is gotten older. I don't believe it. You used to be my age, and now you are much, much, much older than I am. You could be my mother. Unless, of course, I look as old as you and I don't know it. Which is not possible. Or is it? I'm looking around the room and I notice that everyone in it looks like someone. And when I try to figure out exactly who that someone is, it turns out to be a former version of herself. A thinner version. Or a healthier version. Or a pre-plastic surgery version. Or a taller version. If this is true of everyone, it must be true of me, mustn't it? But never mind, you're speaking. Maggie, you say, it's been so long. I'm not Maggie, I say. Oh my God, you say, it's you. I didn't recognize you. You've done something to your hair.
The Cycle by Duard Mosley. Because of the icy patches on the bike path, I plan to ride using the flat side of the pedals. But at some point during my ride, I'd unconsciously clicked into the clip-ons. My bike hit a patch of ice and the back wheel slipped sideways, and I felt the bike falling. I tried urgently to unhook my shoes from the bindings. Still bound to the pedals, I fell on my left side, hip first, onto the concrete sidewalk. Feeling stupid and upset that I'd fallen, I unclicked from the pedals, pushed the bike off me, and tried to stand. A jolt of high-voltage pain shot through me. My left leg collapsed, and I fell back to the sidewalk into a puddle of cold, dirty water, breathing heavily, desperately trying to remain conscious. I pulled myself up to my hands and knees. The pain wasn't so terrible this way. A woman biker stopped and tried to help, but she wasn't strong enough to lift me. Then seemingly, out of nowhere, a man appeared. "Hey, you okay?" he asked. No, it's my hip, really painful," I said. "Let's get you up." I looked at him. He weighed at least 30 pounds less than me. "I don't know. I'm kind of heavy." "I'm strong. Go ahead. Put your arm around me. I can lift you." Feeling his arm around my waist, I decided to trust him. so I put my right arm over his shoulder. He was small in stature, but I felt his strength, and he lifted me to my feet, just as he said he would. We moved to a rail fence where I could take the pressure off my left leg. "Thanks. What's your name?"
"Steve."
"Steve, thank you. I owe you." "Hey, you owe me nothing." I gave the woman biker my cell phone, and she sent a text to my friends who were about a mile ahead of me. The woman called for an ambulance. Steve said, "I can take your bike in the trunk of my car. Don't worry about it. Here's my business card. I'll keep it in my garage until you're ready to pick it up." In the ambulance, the paramedics shot some painkillers into my vein, but I didn't feel relief immediately. The emergency room was huge and empty. I was wheeled into cubicle number 45 to wait for x-ray. A doctor came by and looked at my left foot, which was just poking out from under the sheets. "Dislocated or broken hip, I'd say, from the way the leg is turned." My cell phone rang. "They let you keep them now." It was my estranged wife. We'd been apart for 3 years. "My phone rang and I heard you talking to paramedics. What's going on?"
My phone was in my pocket. Must have dialed you. Sorry."
"What happened this time?" She'd had past experiences with me in bike accidents, ambulances, emergency room, urgent care, etc. "Bike fell on the ice, hurt my hip, just fell over. I was barely moving."
"Do you want me to come there?"
"No, I'll be fine, just a bruise. I wanted to stop talking because it hurt when I spoke and I was close to crying."
"Let me know what's happening," she said.
"Yes, we'll do, bye." It was a broken femur, up high near the part that goes into the hip socket. A surgeon explained the situation and he recommended a total hip replacement. I agreed. Later that day, a gloomy-faced doctor visited my hospital for a chat. Once he had gone, I decided it was time to finally write my will, set up an estate plan, and cancel my deposit on the Tesla Model 3. Apparently, the hip x-ray had revealed some abnormalities of the bone. When combined with the chest x-ray, which showed a mass on my chest wall, Dr. Gloom told me they may be connected.
Mass, as in tumor?
Yes.
Possible tumor in the bone?
Possibly.
So, bone cancer?
Could be. We'll be doing more tests, MRIs, bone scans. I telephoned my closest living relative, my brother, with whom I'd been somewhat distant, and gave him the news.
"What? Oh, no."
And his voice broke. I told him it wasn't certain and they were going to do tests. I vowed to call him more often. 2 days later, prior to surgery, with my estranged wife at my bedside, she and I agreed to get a divorce. We hugged, and I told her I was happy she had found someone. Coincidentally, so had I. According to the radiology department, the MRI is the Cadillac of the scanning machines. One of the nurses told me that the room with the MRI machine was pleasant and tastefully decorated. The ceiling was a backlit art piece of a peaceful woodland scene designed to soothe and relax the patient. However, although I thought the ceiling was beautiful, I didn't feel relaxed since the MRI emitted loud, explosive noises that reminded me of the Saving Private Ryan soundtrack. I enjoyed 2 sessions of MRI scans. I paid particular attention to the ceiling the second time. Yes, much nicer than at other scanning rooms. The CT and bone scan machines were big, ugly tubes with drab tile ceilings. From Sunday until surgery on Tuesday morning, I was up and down from my room to radiology for some scan or other. Painful trips as the attendants put me in various combination of sheets and blankets to fling my inert body from bed to gurney to scan table, back to gurney, back to bed. These trips were fast rolls through the hallways on my hospital bed, which had the amazing ability to shrink so that it would fit into the elevators. Why don't cars shrink? Perfect for that parking spot that's just a wee bit too tight. The bed jockeys were a part of a cadre called patient transportation. The name fit because you'd often be lined up in the hallway with other shrunken beds, waiting patiently for your transportation. After enduring what seemed every scan science has invented, my prognosis was good. No sign of cancer. Yet the surgeon wanted to do a bone biopsy before surgery. The radiology nurse thought this was nuts. They're going to take out the bone and do the surgery no matter what. She told the radiologist, whose surprised reaction, complete with widened eyes and lifted eyebrows, was almost cartoonish. He canceled the biopsy. The surgery went well, and within an hour out of the recovery room, I was walking slowly on my new artificial hip. My medical care was superb, and I feel blessed to have access to it. From the nurse who spoke up to the radiologist on my behalf, to all the people who helped me through my ordeal, I will be forever indebted. Everyone I came in contact with showed genuine concern for my well-being. But especially I want to thank Steve, a man who was driving along the highway, saw someone in need and stopped to help. I will never forget his calming voice and command, "Put your arm around me. I can lift you." And he did. Postscript. I'm doing well with my new hip, back to normal and back on my bike. One day I was driving home from work and I saw a man on his knees in the driveway. A woman was at his side and I couldn't tell what had happened. I drove past, but then I thought they may need help. I turned around and parked at the side of the road. "Can I help?" I asked. "He got dizzy and fell. I was driving by and stopped, but I can't lift him," the woman said. "I can," I said, and I did.
Thank you for listening today. Be sure to join us for our next episode of Mind Expanding Tales.
Storytime for Grownups is recorded at Elmhurst Public Library's Creative Studio Lab. Our director and editor is Josh Jers, our producer and host is Margie Colewalker, and our stories today were narrated by Duard Mosley. Works read in this podcast may be protected under copyright law. These podcasts are reserved for the education of library patrons only. Elmhurst Public Library receives no commercial gain from these recordings. No unauthorized further dissemination of these works is permitted.